Ja, ich versuche mal Chromebook abzunehmen. Audio is goed, beeld is goed. Oké, cool. Okay, good morning. Welcome in Leuven, the beautiful Belgium. Well, this session is about securing Exchange Online. My name is Dave Stork, but just to get this out of the way, we have to thank our sponsors for making this event possible. So, in the middle room, the sponsors have some booths, so please check them out, and maybe they have some valuable information. So, I'm Dave Stork. I'm an architect at OGD ICT Services, based in the Netherlands. I'm also an MVP. Microsoft MVP in Office servers and services. Also, Microsoft Certified Trainer. If you want to contact me or find out about me and what I'm writing about, my information is here. And I'm also a co-author of the Practical PowerShell for Exchange 2016. You could buy it, the book there at this URL. Just a friendly note. Well, in this session, there's not, unfortunately, not much PowerShell. But what do I talk about? Well, I'm going to talk about the client-server connections to Exchange Online. So basically, client-server connections, maybe I should have said service connections, but well, that's semantics, I guess. I'm also going to talk about securing your mail flow and also about data security, data governance, and stuff like that. And if time will allow it, then I will try to answer your questions. During the sessions, feel free to ask any questions as long as it's short. If it's going to lead into a longer discussion, we'll have to ask you to do that after the session. In the afternoon, there's also an expert panel, so you could ask me some questions there, or when I'm walking around drinking some coffee or whatever. So, first off, I have a question for the audience. And in a lot of discussions with customers, I'm mainly an Exchange on-premises guy, but the future is in the cloud. And a lot of discussions I have with customers that are still on-prem is when they have certain challenges, I pose the questions, well, why don't you go to the cloud and use Exchange Online? Well, a lot of customers say, well, it's not safe and this and that. So in the audience, how many of you think or have customers let's say the cloud is not safe? No one? One, two? Okay. Three. So, and I hope with this session to somewhat highlight the difference between the possibilities for securing Exchange Online or securing Exchange and the difference between the on-premises capabilities and the cloud capabilities. Some capabilities are similar or equal in on-premises Exchange environments or in cloud environments. But there are some unique capabilities in Exchange Online. So client-server connections. This presentation was previously a on-premises presentation, and I think I had something about 10 slides just specifically devoted to securing your on-premises Exchange server. But because Exchange Online is a SaaS software as a service, so those challenges are already managed by Microsoft themselves. So I could throw out a lot of slides, just like my servers. This is my on-prem environment years ago, and then at the right hand side is the situation after I went to the cloud. So there's a lot of hardware lost there, but also a lot of management and responsibility. So that's a good thing, I felt, at least. So this is one of the slides I kept, and this is to show you that the connections towards Exchange Online are quite safe. This is a command prompt with the OpenSSL tool. You can download that for free. And I use that to simulate a client connection towards the Outlook, the Exchange Online service. And the result here is the information about the secure connection towards outlook.office365.com. And if you look closely, and I have to try this out with the zoom, you see here this connection is protected with TLS version 1.2 and has a pretty good cipher. It's maybe not the most secure cipher, but it's currently secure enough. So TLS version 1.2, that's the best you can do. And the cipher is also already pretty good. And this is out of the box, basically. So just to prove to you that the connection towards Exchange Online is already protected. Were you on-prem, you had to do some specific modifications on your Exchange server or your web publishing proxy or load balancer or stuff like that. Well, all that is already done by Microsoft. So let's go to the another sheet. So a lot of those things are already done. But another way, so the transport and the data connection towards Exchange Online is already protected, but there are other means to further protect your data in Exchange Online. And one thing is multi-factor authentication. It's my opinion, my personal opinion, that the traditional way of authenticating just with a username and a password is outdated. There are a lot of challenges nowadays, and one of the things to add an extra level of security is the multi-factor authentication. And you can use that in Exchange Online via different methods, with a token or with the Microsoft Authenticator app, or with SMS or phone calls or stuff like that. But in any case, there is an extra layer or an extra set of credentials you have to provide before you have access to Exchange Online. And in the case of Exchange Online, multi-factor authentication is present for all Exchange protocols, not just limited to OWA or the Exchange Control Panel, but for full Outlook, for instance. So the Outlook Anywhere or the newest term maybe over HTTPS. I'm not sure how you pronounce that correctly, but the application has to support modern authentication, and there are some applications that support that. For instance, Outlook 2013, you have to enable it with the registry key, but it's also present in Outlook 2016 and it's fully operational. You have to have, don't have to do anything extra. But also Outlook for Mac, the Outlook app for iOS and Android also has modern authentication, thus multi-factor authentication, and the Windows 10 mail application on your Windows 10 desktop computer, but also your Windows 10 mobile phone for those that still use that. So multi-factor authentication, because like I said, it's one thing you actually should implement, in my opinion. But what are the possibilities for on-premises? Well, unfortunately, currently the only way to use multi-factor authentication for your on-premises service is for OWA and the ECP virtual directory, or the Exchange Control Panel, for options and for admin purposes. So not for the FAT client Outlook, not for ActiveSync and stuff like that, only for the web-based. So that is a downside for the on-premises scenario. Another option for authentication, and this is limited for mobile devices, is certificate-based authentication. But I have to stress, this is not a additional authentication method next to your username and credential. It's actually a replacement for that. The authentication is performed by a user certificate. And there are some infrastructural requirements you have to implement. But why would you implement that? Well, for instance, if you change your password and you don't use certificate-based authentication, then you would have to re-enter your password on all your devices using ActiveSync or something like that. So certificate-based authentication, well, it's a little bit an odd duck if you're talking about securing Exchange, but it's something you, I think, have to consider. Well, here are some of the specific demands. You have to have a certificate authority with an internet-facing revocation list URL. The certificate has to contain the primary STP address, etc., etc. So it's maybe not easy to implement, but if you have a requirement or if you want to provide benefits, for instance, if you have a password policy that says change your password every 3 months, well, maybe this is something that helps your users to comply with that without the hassle of changing the password. And then another way to secure your Exchange Online, the access to Exchange Online, is by using Azure AD Conditional Access. And with this, you can grant access to services, Exchange Online, when certain conditions are met. And this is not just limited to mobile devices. You can also implement it for desktop or tablets or stuff like that, or web browsers. You can, next to allowing or disallowing access, you can also make the condition that when you are, for instance, out of the office, multi-factor authentication is mandatory. So when your user is in the office, no multi-factor authentication may be required, but when that user is on a holiday or on a business trip or a conference like this, then you can, as an organization, you can make mandatory that multi-factor authentication has to be met. And those variables are, for instance, group membership, well, location, already mentioned that, device state, or something like the device operating system. For instance, if your organization only supports Windows laptops, you can limit the access only for Windows laptops, and not for macOS. So in this way, well, we talked about securing the access or the connection. We talked about multi-factor authentication, and now here with this, you can control when and where somebody can actually have access. So I was talking about exchange online and a little bit of on-premises, but if you are in the cloud or using Exchange Online, there's a pretty good chance you still have a on-premises Exchange server. And that if you have directory synchronization enabled in your tenant and you synchronize your AD objects from on-prem to towards Exchange Online or Office 365, you still require an Exchange server on-premises for management purposes. Because the startup authority, or in a bit of more layman terms, the only object you can edit are your on-premises objects. So for instance, if you want to add an email address, you have to do that on-premises. And then AAD Connect, the directory synchronization tool, will synchronize that change towards Exchange Online. And then in Exchange Online, that mailbox will get an extra SDP address. That is the only supported way to manage your objects. So if you have directory synchronization, you probably have a hybrid server. And actually, we're not allowed to call it hybrid server, but I was a bit lazy, so I just added the quotes, air quotes. But there are two distinct possibilities with the hybrid configuration. For instance, you could have full hybrid. And in this case, I mean that you have also on-premises mailboxes that are accessed by your users, also cloud mailboxes. Well, in that case, that hybrid server isn't actually just only a hybrid server, but it also has data in it. And that means that you have to approach that security of that Exchange server as if it's your only Exchange server. So, and then you have to secure it like any on-premises Exchange server. Unfortunately, like I said in previous slides, multi-factor authentication is not possible. So there are some extra challenges when you allow your users to connect to your on-premises Exchange environment. So some organizations say, well, when your mailbox is on-premises, you don't have any access to your on-premises Exchange environment and only access to your Exchange Online with potentially additional security measures like MFA or conditional access. But when it's only used for management and there's no data on that hybrid server, you could limit the connectivity to that Exchange server and only allow connectivity towards Office 365 IP addresses. You could limit what is published of that on-premises server. And for instance, one of the things that is somewhat of a discussion point or some frequently asked questions actually, is the auto-discovered DNS record. Well, in this case, if you don't have any on-premises mailboxes, you could point all your auto-discovered DNS records towards Exchange Online, because auto-discover is required to find that mailbox. So if you don't have any mailboxes on-premises, you don't have any need for auto-discover pointing towards your on-premises server. And that limits the URLs you have to publish. So when talking about securing Exchange Online, if you have a hybrid configuration, don't forget that on-premises server. So that was the topic about securing the client and a question.
Question about the auto-discover thing.
Yeah.
Is there any reason or any environment which recommended to point auto-discover hybrid environment?
Mm-hmm.
It's recommended to point auto-discover to on-prem?
The question is, if I've summarize that correctly, if there's a reason to point it towards on-prem, your auto-discovery URL?
In any case.
Well, basically, if you have data in an if you have a mailbox in either on-prem, then you have to point your out of discovery record externally and internally towards your on-premises Exchange server. And if you also have cloud mailboxes next to your on-premises mailboxes, then the on-premises auto-discover process knows about your mailbox, where that mailbox is. Yes, indeed. And it will redirect towards automatically towards Exchange Online.
And the other way around, it isn't redirected as well?
Good question. If it does Exchange Online redirect auto-discover requests towards your on-premises Exchange server, officially no. Yeah. Sometimes I think they try sometimes to make it work and stuff like that, but officially it's not supported.
So officially, if only you have a single mailbox on-prem, you should point your auto-discover records to on-prem.
If you use clients that have to use auto-discover to find that mailbox. If for instance, that mailbox is only accessed via OWA, then it's no issue. Yeah. So for Outlook, that's a requirement. Yeah. Good question. Thank you. So, mail flow. Well, what are the challenges with mail or incoming mail, outgoing mail? Well, spam, malware, phishing, spoofing, whether you want to encrypt that mail or not, stuff like that. And also, important things to remember is that is something weird. Okay, it's back again. Sorry about that. I have a new pointer and I'm still figuring out the kinks of that. So another thing to consider with mail flow is what is the source and what is the target of your email? Is it from unknown third parties, or is it, for instance, from partners your organization works with intensively? So that could mean some things for some solutions you're going to see in the next slides. So first off, malware, etc. filtering. If you're using Exchange Online or Office 365, that feature or that capability is provided by Exchange Online Protection. And in most plans, it's already included, so you don't have to pay for it extra. You can extend it with the extra capability of Advanced Threat Protection, and more about that later. Or now, actually. Well, Exchange Online Protection is just the basic filtering. It uses multiple engines, and you can configure it with what happens with the spam mail. Does it land in the user junk folder, or do you use a quarantine web page? Stuff like that. And also, Exchange Online Protection can also be used if you have an on-premises Exchange environment. You just have to point your MX records towards Exchange Online Protection, and then Exchange Online Protection knows where your Exchange servers are, and then delivers the mail, hopefully fully cleaned and safe. But there are some configuration possibilities available to further tweak your needs. But there are some extra benefits if you use Exchange Online mailboxes. And one of the benefits is Advanced Threat Protection. It's an additional license per mailbox. I think about €1 per month per user per mailbox. And there are two most important features in this. The first one is the replacement of URLs within the mail with safe links. And safe links are just a replacement of a URL. And then if you or a user clicks on that link, then Microsoft will check if that site is malicious. If it's malicious, you don't get access. If it's safe, you get direct access. And the great thing about this is that it works on every device. So even on your mobile device, if you receive a mail, it's already protected. You can whitelist URLs, so for your own website, you can prevent the replacement of those URLs. Another option is the detonation of unknown attachments or safe attachments. So if an unknown attachment is received by Exchange Online Protection and it hasn't been scanned previously, then it will detonate it in a virtual environment and sees what happens and tries to find out whether that document or whatever has some unsafe elements in it. And if it's unsafe, then it can be blocked, rejected, stuff like that. It can add some delay in the delivery. Previously it was, well, maybe 45 to 30 minutes, and currently it's about 15 minutes, I think. For that, Microsoft has the option to dynamic deliver your mail. And actually what it does is it strips the attachment from that mail, it delivers the mail without an attachment, it does has a placeholder, and then you can read that mail. And in the meantime, Advanced Threat Protection is scanning that attachment, and then when that attachment is deemed safe, then ATP will replace your mail and will add that attachment within that mail. Funny thing is that it can mean that you get multiple notifications of that you have received a new mail. That's just a little, how do you say that? It could be confusing. Sometimes you just got a notification of a mail, and then 15 minutes later you get another notification of that same mail. But anyway, that is an option, and that can is some solution for that delay. So how does that see looks like? Well, in this case, I open a URL in a mail, and in this case that URL was malicious, and then your users sees this page. This page could not be loaded. Well, in this case, it was an internal error, but it's basically somewhat same message. So it's a lot of red, a lot of exclamation points and stuff like that. So it's a clear signal to the user that that mail and that URL wasn't safe. And how does dynamic delivery work? Well, this is a screenshot of my iPhone. And then you see, here you see the temporary attachment ATP scan in progress EML. And if you open that mail, you can see an explanation that your attachment will arrive shortly and stuff like that. But this is the user experience of the dynamic delivery of ATP. So, for again, for malware, etc. filtering, there are some organizations that aren't happy with Exchange Online Protection or are required by law or internal policies to use a specific product. Well, that is possible, but you have to put that product before Exchange Online Protection, and you are not allowed, it's not supported to place that product between your on-premises Exchange and Office 365 or Exchange Online mail flow. That mail flow has to be uninterrupted, or only an Exchange Edge transport is allowed. And you could place a third-party mail software on that Edge transport server if you're worried about that. A question, yeah. That's a good question. The question is ATP only supported with Exchange Online mailboxes? Let me see. I think safe links are supported if you put it if your first entry point is Exchange Online Protection, and then will mail flow to your on-premises mailbox, yes. Safe attachments only partly because dynamic delivery requires that that mailbox is in Exchange Online, because it has to change something in the mailbox, has to replace a mailbox, and that is a lot more difficult with an on-premises server. So, good question, thank you, again. So, what if you use centralized mail flow? And centralized mail flow, for those who don't know, well, the sort of basic, the default option is to point your MX records towards Exchange Online Protection, and all incoming and outgoing mail flow is via Exchange Online Protection. But for whatever reason, compliance, regulation, whatever, you can choose to use centralized mail flow. And that means that all incoming and outgoing mail flow is via your on-premises Exchange server. So even if you have a cloud mailbox, that mail, outgoing mail, is transported to your on-premises mail servers and then outwards towards the internet. Well, if you use centralized mail flow, you have to use a mail filtering product before your on-premises Exchange servers, obviously. And you can use whatever you would like to use, so as long as the mail flow communication between your on-premises and Exchange Online is not included in that filtering. Well, here was that answer to your question. ATP will do nothing. I will save things, I think. Well, in this case, centralized mail flow, because it doesn't come in towards Exchange Online Protection, it does nothing. So it's a little bit a different answer to a similar question, but you don't use anything from Exchange Online Protection. That's the message if you use centralized mail flow. So,
another question. Yeah. Sorry again for taking a lot of you. If you can configure a centralized mail flow in your hybrid configuration
wizard, yeah, to
enable for outgoing mail. But if you do that and only enable for outgoing mail, is that also a supported situation? Because I don't. The reason I'm asking, if you only enable for outgoing, have control over your outgoing data, but you can also take advantage of advanced web protection of your incoming mail, or is that an unsupported?
That's actually a good question. The question is that incoming mail, can you do incoming mail via AOP and outgoing mail always between from your on-premises environment?
It's technically possible,
yes, but is it supported? That's a good question. I believe it is. Yeah. but it's for me, it's a little bit why would you want to do that? But you might have reasons for that. Yeah. Okay. Another way to secure your mail flow is the Sender Policy Framework, SPF Wrapper. And basically what it does is an anti-spoofing method. And you place a text record in your in DNS in your mail domain, and that tells other receiving mail servers whether that IP address or domain name is allowed to mail for your domain. And the receiving mail server sees the from field, sees the domain after the at symbol, and then checks in DNS whether that server is allowed, and then in the headers or connection information will correlate that with that. And if it doesn't match, then it depends on your configuration, it gets a reject or hard fail, or gets an increased spam confidence level. But don't forget any other services that mail from your domain, for instance, MailChimp or other mailing services. Don't forget those to include in your SPF record. So that is a tricky bit. But in my opinion, this is an absolute minimum configuration you have to have. And I still find some companies that don't even have an SPF record. But there are more and more mail services that give a penalty if you don't have an SPF record. For instance, Outlook.com, Yahoo, even and Google, give an extra warning if you don't have an SPF record.
So you said in the receiving end on the exchange control.
Sorry? How do you control what the receiving server does? Sort of, yeah. Well, here below you have a response of the Microsoft.com SPF record. If you can, and here at the, well, you have the version of the SPF, and here you see all the domain names and IP addresses that are allowed to mail for the Microsoft.com domain. And at the end, you have, yes, I've got it, a dash all. And in that case, it's an information to the receiving server that if there's any IP address or domain that doesn't allow this, then you have to consider that that is a spoofed mail. And then, well, I'm not really certain what about the RFC specifications, but it's basically sort of dependent on the configuration of the receiving server. But basically what you say is, in this case, well, hey, if it's from another IP address, you shouldn't trust this. And most organizations ask, okay, we don't trust it. Yeah. But it's not enforced in any way. There are some other solutions that try to fill that gap. One of those is the domains keys identified mail or DKIM. And it's also a record in your DNS. But what it does, it signs your outgoing mail with a private key. But it also, if your environment is DKIM enabled, it can check incoming mail whether that signature is correct. And it checks that with the public key, and that public key is published in the DNS of the sending environment. And that means that you have a high degree of certainty that that mail is actually from the server it claims it is. With SPF, it only checks the from field, so you can spoof some elements of that. But with DKIM, you have a real signature, and that is a lot more certain that that mail is actually from the organization that it claims it is. And it can help with filtering of malicious mail, but especially spoofing. And also an extra benefit is that you can check whether a mail or a message has been changed after it left the signing server. That has some downsides, because if there are valid changes in a mail, then that signing, the receiving server might fail that DKIM check. One important thing, there is no native exchange support. So on premises, you don't have DKIM. You have to leverage or use a additional solution to use DKIM for incoming and outgoing. But in Office 365 or Exchange Online, this process is handled by Exchange Online Protection. And it's quite easy to configure, because you only have to do basically two kinds of things, or three kinds. You have to enable it on your domain, and you have to create two CNAME records to a subdomain of your tenant URL, in this case Contoso on Microsoft.com, and that that record is, for instance, selector 1 contoso.com domain key dot contoso on Microsoft.com, and that so you have a CNAME on your contoso.com record that points towards that subdomain, an on Microsoft subdomain, and that the subdomain has a text record, and that text record contains the public key. And this is an example of a DKIM text record with the public key. So now we have SPF and DKIM, and you can also additionally add extra security. There's a question? Yes?
It
depends on where the check is performed and what because before, for instance, ATP changes the content of your mail, so that signature would be invalid. But luckily, in that case, the DKIM check was performed before ATP comes into play. So within exchange online, that should be okay for at least the whole message, not specifically the message body, because there are mostly changes. But I haven't found any issues with this kind of thing, but it's something to consider. So, and we have SBF, DKIM, and we have DMARC, domain-based message authentication, reporting, and conformance. Well, it's additional to SBF and DKIM, and it instructs the receiving server, if it supports DMARC, what to do with a message that fails SBF or DKIM. And the most beneficial part is that it can send reports back to the spoofed domain. You can add a mail address to where those reports had to be sent, so that admin knows, oh, somebody tries to spoof me, and then you can take extra actions. How is this configured? Well, also in DNS with the text record, basically comparable with the SPF, containing instructions for the receiving side what to do. And also in this case, there's no native exchange support. So on premises, you also have to use extra capabilities, especially for if you want to check it or send reports and that kind of stuff. And also the report that's only supported by not all domains support sending a report towards you. I know that Google and Yahoo and Microsoft support it, so they send reports back to the spoof domain if that is configured. The question is,
which third-party vendors do support DKIM and DMARC
on-site? That's a very good question. The question was which vendors support on-premises DKIM and DMARC. I'm not privy to that knowledge at this time, but there are some solutions, and my default advisory for organizations that are still on premises is to, and they have to choose a filtering solution, whether it's a cloud solution or an on-premises appliance or something like that, is to check whether DKIM and DMARC support is included. There are some solutions, but I don't know them by heart. Yeah.
Is this something that, in your experience, is becoming the default, the standard? Because I don't have the impression that for on-premise, I mean, this is mainstream yet.
The remark is this already mainstream, or does it have a high implementation rate? Unfortunately, no. But there is a definite increase in interest in this. In the Netherlands, the government has put out an advisory to implement DMARC, or at least DKIM, or some part of this. And if you don't, all three?
All three next year.
So next year. But it's not highly mandatory. It's only if. But if you don't can, you have to explain why you can't do it. I think there was a sort of a small loophole, or I'm confusing it with Dane. I'm probably confusing it with that. But in any case, there is a trend that there are more regulatory, mandatory things that you have to implement that. So especially if you now have to make an investment in this kind of solutions, that certainly has to be on your selection list. Yeah. So, and how does a DMARC record look like? Well, I'm not going to explain it, but it's basically the same as an SPF record. Here you see the DMARC, and you see some information. I'm not going through it, but for instance, here you see a mail address to where those reports can be sent. Oh, sorry. And in the slides in the comments, I have put in some URLs to further, so you can further investigate that technique. If you look at the message headers of a message, and this is from my Office 365 tenant towards outlook.com, and here in the authentication results at the top, you see an SPF, it has passed. So that IP address is allowed to mail. And a little bit further, you see they can pass, signature was verified. So in this case, you know, okay, this is a valid domain and it's allowed. And you see also here the received SPF, so you see some more information about the SPF record. And here below, you see the DKIM signature. So in this case, you can check in the headers whether it's a valid mail or not. So, and how does a DMARC report look like? Well, in most cases, just a zip file and an XML file. And it has, well, information like, this is the organization that has received a spoofed mail. And it says, well, it's for clump.nl.nl, but it has received a mail from this IP address, and that wasn't valid. So in this case, you know, okay, that IP address is doing something weird with my domain, it's trying to spoof it. So you can use this information to try to mitigate those kinds of attacks. Well, this is not very friendly. So for instance, daymarkin.com is a cloud solution that you can send your reports towards that service, and then it gives some nice looking graphs like this and some more human readable information like, well, Google said that this domain tried to mail, tried to spoof something. So, and it's from Russia, so. Okay. So that was SPF, DMARC, DKIM. We go back a little bit back to STP and transport layer security. And there we have two important options. We have the opportunistic TLS, and that's best effort encryption or connection between STP servers. And there are some certain requirements, but if those requirements aren't met, there's always a fallback to an unencrypted SMTP. Just, it's more important to receive the mail than that it's important to have it securely transported. If you have a partner and you have some confidential email correspondence, you could use mutual TLS or domain security, and that forces authentication and encryption. And the requirements for instance, for your certificates are more strict because it has to be trusted. And with opportunistic, it doesn't have to be trusted. But most importantly, there's no fallback. So if those requirements are not met or it fails for whatever reason, the certificate name isn't correct or isn't trusted, then there's no fallback and there's no mail transport. In Exchange Online and on-premises, you have to configure this for each specific domain. You have to create receive connectors, send connectors, stuff like that. So that's kind of cumbersome on the, to use this. So you are a little bit, well, in a sort of a limbo because you want actually sort of a best of both worlds. And then we come to Dane. Dane is the DNS-based authentication of named entities. And if you want to read about that more specifically about the config or the RFC is 7672. And basically it prevents downgrade attacks of SMTP TLS, for instance, via man-in-the-middle attack, or it also ensures that the mail server that is found in DNS is correct and not spoofed via DNS cache points and other solutions. And this is one of the requirements that is a, you have to implement it or otherwise explain why you didn't do it in Dutch government. Is it available in Exchange Online? Well, I tried to find any information about this, but I couldn't find any. But also I have to be honest, this is, even DKIM and DMARC are quite new for my in my experience, or there's not a lot of experience with that. Dane, it's a lot worse because I don't know a lot about it, so I have to do some more homework in it. But I still wanted to mention this technique, and possibly we can see this implemented in Exchange Online soon. So we talked about the transportation of mail, secure transportation of mail, connections, etc. But what about if you want to have a user-to-user secured mail? Well, one encrypted mail, and one of the solutions is S/MIME, and it can sign and assign and encrypt messages, and it's certificate-based, and the sender and receiver require each other public keys to, in order to sign, or sorry, to encrypt mail. Downsides are limited client compatibility. Not all browsers support the plugin. In Outlook, you have to configure each Outlook client for S/MIME. And also in this case, if you have transport rules or anything else that change the content of the mail, that will break S/MIME or the signature or the encryption. So that is tricky, and I don't like S/MIME because it's too cumbersome. And I try to some organizations try to use it, and they were like, this isn't very user friendly. But if security is paramount, then S/MIME is an option. And it's both on premises and exchange online because it's a client encryption. It's start the encryptions and signing is on the client and decryption also on the client. Well, another option is specifically for Office 365 is the message encryption. So what is it? Well, a user sends a mail to a recipient. Your organization has set some rules. This has to be encrypted. The recipient receives a link, not the original mail. The recipient opens links, authenticates, and can read the message, and for instance, also the attachment. And then if that person replies, that replies are sent back to the original sender. But the most important thing is that that original message is present on the Office 365 servers and not on the receiving side solution. It does require Azure Rights Management. Another downside, and let's add license cost. And other downside is that there is no end user trigger. The organization has to set rules. And there is no history of your correspondence at the recipient site. So that's also a bit of a downside. Sorry, I'm a little bit for time, so I have to do that at the end. So how does it look like? Well, this is a mail what the recipient receives. It is an attachment with a message HTML. You can customize it with your own logo so that, the recipient knows, okay, this is okay, but probably it's good to call that user, you get an encrypted mail or something like that. And when that recipient opens that message, then it opens a website and you can sign in or use a one-time passcode. And I believe that there are currently other authentication methods available, and then you can view the message. So that is Office 365 message encryption. And it can also be used with on-premises mailboxes if you have your mail flow through Exchange Online Protection, your outgoing mail flow. So we talked about client-server connections, mail flow, encryption of messages, and now a little bit of data security. So data security challenges, accidental leaks, unauthorized access and controlled access, and accountability of actions. And well, when I was updating the sheets and converting it from an on-premises viewpoint to an Office 365 viewpoint, I saw that there's currently quite a lot of new developments in Office 365 concerning these subjects. And there are a lot of differences, and there will be a lot more differences with on-premises exchange. And we saw some of those things very shortly in the keynote this morning. Data loss prevention. It is a solution to prevent accidental leaks of confidential information. And you can set policies, and it uses regular expressions, functions, keywords to detect sensitive information types. And common sensitive information types are already present. For instance, the Belgium civil number or something like that. Yeah. Credit card numbers, IP addresses, stuff like that are already present in Exchange Online, and some of them also in Exchange 2013 on-premises and 2016 on-premises. But you can also make some custom types. It's not easy. You have to create XML things and it's kind of nasty. So, but hopefully the custom or the common types, the default types are good enough. So in a Exchange Online context, if somebody has a sensitive information type, the user will get a policy tip or somewhat equal to a mail tip. And then the user is warned about you're trying to send sensitive information. And it also is triggered when saving a draft. There are some overrides options and stuff like that, or you can just monitor. There are different options with that. But if you look now in Exchange Online and in your Exchange Admin Center, you will see that it has been moved to the Security and Compliance Center. And this is because data loss prevention now in Office 365 can also protect OneDrive and SharePoint information. And there are a lot of other improvements available. So if you look up data loss prevention, be sure to check the correct information, whether you have an on-premises server or a Exchange Online. And how does that look like? Well, in this case, I've entered an IP address and you get a policy tip with information containing, and where's my end? Since this message appears to contain sensitive information, and then it shows you what kind of information is present. And it also works for attachments attached to this mail. It's kind of a buggy pointer. Unfortunately, it only lists one and the most important sensitive information type. So if you have multiple hits, the most important one is shown. If you resolve that, then it could be that the second one, for instance, credit card information is shown, and then you have to solve that, et cetera, et cetera. But this is quite nice solution. So, Azure Information Protection, or AKA Azure Rights Management, AKA Information Rights Management, AKA, I don't know what they were thinking. It looks like they had somebody from Citrix marketing in place. So and that made it a little bit different, difficult for me to quickly and easily summarize what you can do with it. But the main thing is you can protect documents and data, even if it leaves the organization. You can prevent the printing of a mail or documents or forwarding or stuff like that. And the user can determine what has to happen with that specific object, but it uses predefined policies set by your admin. And it also can monitor and audit protected documents. So you can also see when somebody else, for instance, in another company, opens a document when it's allowed, and you can monitor that. And this is specifically for Office 365. Clients need to support it the Office Suite does support it, so that you're okay. But there are also viewers available if you don't have the full-fledged Office. And for those organizations or individuals that don't have RMS available, because even business to business, both organizations have to have RMS. There is a free RMS subscription available, so you can use this. For instance, if you have a consultant, external consultant, for instance, you can use this, and that consultant, you can use the RMS subscription to read the mail. Still, it's not 100% security. Things like screenshots, photography, just writing some stuff down. Still possible. Some like screenshots and copy paste can be leveraged with, for instance, mobile application management, and most of the Microsoft mobile apps support that. But still keep in mind it's not 100%, but it's in a lot of cases good enough. And how does it look like? Well, for instance, in this case, I have a new mail and I can set permissions on that mail. And for instance, in this case, I've chosen unrestricted access, but I can also set do not forward. And in that case, the recipient cannot forward that mail. And there are a lot of other options possible with those policies. Well, the last thing, I hope, is auditing. And that logs which action on an item is performed by whom. Logins, folder message, access to a folder or a mailbox, create, delete, move, send as, etc. And for admin actions is already enabled. So admin actions already logged, but you have to manually activate it for user mailboxes or other types of mailboxes. For instance, the shared mailbox. And that is one advisory I like to give you. Is if you have a shared mailbox, it's probably a good idea to activate auditing, because you might have to resolve a conflict with who deleted that mail or sent that other mail that was very inflammatory. Well, in that case, with auditing, you can prove that. This is a duplicate. Yeah, this is duplicate, sorry. Okay, and this is still available in the Exchange Admin Center, but also there is within the security and compliance option in your admin portal in Office 365, you have the audit log search, and that can include audit results from other Office 365 services like OneDrive and SharePoint. And there you have the option to create an activity alert. So if some specific action happens, you get a message like, hey, this happened. I wrote a blog post about that. It's included in the notes. But to be clear, this is a general audit log, but you still have to enable it per mailbox in order to see that in the audit log search via the Security and Compliance Center. And how does that look like? Well, this is a admin report. And here you see the date that which command has been performed. In this case, set organization config. It's performed by me, and you can see what was I trying to do. Oh, I was trying to do a distribution group naming policy. So I tried to change that. So in this case, I know what happened and I can prove it. And that is also important. This means it's important to give your admins personalized admin accounts and not a general admin account. You have to lock that up and never use that. So to summarize, I'm a little bit over time, so bear with me. So we looked at secure connections. We have MFA. It's easy in Exchange Online, hard on-prem. Conditional access. And don't forget securing your last on-premises Exchange server. For your mail flow, well, malware filtering with EOP or additionally ATP. You have some choices with third-party solution or your centralized logging, centralized mail flow. And additionally, SPF, DKIM, DMARC, and perhaps DANE in the future. For message encryption, you have SMIME and the Office 365 message encryption. And last, as for data security, DLP IRM, well, that is the old acronym, and auditing as your solutions. Well, did I forget something? Well, yeah, sure. Here's some terms I thought about later, like, oh, I didn't talk about this or didn't talk about this, but I'm already 3 minutes over time, so. Unfortunately, I believe that Tony Redmond has something to say about compliance for groups, Office 365 groups. Oh, okay. Never mind. So, to come back to the audience questions, there were about five fingers who said, like, yeah, cloud is, or heard from customers or feel themselves cloud is insecure. What do you feel about that now? Who feels that the cloud is less safe than on-premises?
I don't see any hands.
Okay, another question. Who thinks that on-premises has some extra challenges that Exchange Online doesn't have?
Yeah.
So, that was my presentation. I would like to thank again our sponsors for making this event possible. There are two sponsor sessions in this room this afternoon. During the lunch break. So, and that is now, I'm eating up your lunch break, sorry about that. So if you want to attend those sessions, you can stay here. Unfortunately, I have no time for Q&A during the session, but feel free to attack me whatever I, wherever I am. And I would like to thank you for your attention.